Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Monday, October 7th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our brand new redesigned website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com, or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com, or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea, technology you can trust.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All right. Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. I hope you all had a fabulous weekend. We had some beautiful weather up here in the northeast Georgia mountains where we're currently staying before we head to Florida for the winter, which may be a stop in Nashville for a big event up there. But I do hope you had a wonderful, wonderful fall weekend. The leaves are changing, and I guess fall is in the air. And believe it or not, before you know it, since it's already fall, I don't know, it'll be maybe Christmas. Okay, I'm not going to bore you to death with the rest of that song, but where did this year go by? Hey, we got a great show lined up for you today. We have Peter Brown, the chicken doctor, that's going to be here. We've got a great topic. Everybody loves Peter Brown, the chicken doctor. He joins us every single Monday. In fact, we've got a great show lined up for you all this week. So today we've got Peter Brown, the chicken doctor. Tomorrow we're going to have the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy joining us. That'll be tomorrow. This coming Wednesday, we've got Ask the Quail Lady, Alexandra Douglas. That's this Wednesday. And then this Thursday, we've got Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, coming on. And a full week of great shows. Get those Chicken Whisperer notebooks out and get ready to take some notes all week long. You got to love it. So we thank you very much for tuning in. I'll send a real quick shout out, like I normally do, first and foremost, to all the homeschoolers that listen to the show. We hear from you regularly. Thank you so much. I'm glad you're incorporating the show daily into your homeschool curriculum. We thank you for tuning in. All of the over-the-road truck drivers, yep, you over-the-road truck drivers getting that freight delivered across the country, we hear from you too. Thank you very much for tuning in when you can on iTunes.com, podcast.com, Zoom.com, and, of course, blogtalkradio.com. Keep the rubber on the road. We thank you for tuning in. Of course, all of our live listeners that listen live, all of our archive listeners that listen in the evenings and midnight, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., there's thousands of you, and I thank you for listening to the archive show of this broadcast. Thank you very much. And last but not least, all of the feed and seed stores across this great land that stream this radio show live every day for their shoppers' enjoyment. So thank you, Feed and Seed Stores, for streaming us live. And I hope sales were good over the weekend, and hope you're having a good year. So we thank you for streaming us live for all of your shoppers. I do have some chickens in the news. We'll share that with everybody as we wait for Peter Brown to give us a call in. Let me get over here to our chickens in the news segment. I haven't really proofread these 100% yet, but I'll be posting these on our Facebook page in a little bit. Probably after the show, I'll be posting it on our Facebook page. And as well, on Facebook this afternoon, I'm going to be giving away to one lucky Facebook fan a one-year subscription to Back Home Magazine. Yes, Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. He comes on the show the second and fourth Thursday of every month with some great homesteading topics and self-sufficient topics. So he's going to be joining us this Thursday, matter of fact. But I will be giving away one of a year subscription to his magazine later today on our Facebook page. So this comes to us from ABC Radio, their rural department, and the title is Free Range Hens May Not Be Happier Than Caged. Okay, and I know most of my listeners out there are shaking their heads or calling, yeah, whatever, whatever. But that's the title. I knew it'd get your attention, so I definitely got to post it later on our Facebook page. Because everybody, I guess, has their opinion. Free-range hens may not be happier than caged. A study suggests free-range chickens are not necessarily happier than their caged cousins. Last week, Woolworths announced it will phase out eggs laid by caged hens by 2018 in response to animal welfare concerns. Dr. Jeff Downing from the Faculty of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney, Australia, says caged hens may not be any more stressed than free-range hens. His research, his research, funded by the Australian Egg Corporation, Orange juice has been proven to prevent certain types of cancer, a study paid for by Minute Maid. Okay, his research, funded by the Australian Egg Corporation, has tested the stress levels of chickens in a range of egg-producing systems. Not sure how you do that, but Dr. Dowling said there is no distinct difference between the stress levels encountered by caged, barn, or free-range chickens. What we found in any of these production systems is that there can be big variations between the stress levels that we measure from flocks on different farms. What's happening on the farm itself seems to be more important than actually the production system and the levels of stress the hens are experiencing. Dr. Downing identifies stress levels in chickens by measuring the quantity of stress hormones, corticortisone, in the albumen of their eggs. The albumen develops over a four-hour period the day before the egg is laid. My work showed that there is a different relationship between the levels of these stress hormones in blood plasma and the egg, so we're able to use eggs as a non-invasive measure. Dr. Downing found that environmental factors such as heat and social factors are main causes of stress in chickens. And in evolutionary terms, hens lived in small group sizes. Once you get into very large group sizes, there is much social interaction that this can be quite stressful for some hens. There is far more potential in these big group sizes for social stress. Dr. Downing says Woolworth's move to phase out eggs laid by caged hens will offer no guarantees to customers. If you went into a supermarket and you just looked at the production system and you chose eggs based on that, there's no guarantee that those eggs came from a farm where hens were less stressed than other production system, or maybe even another farm. Federal Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce says he is concerned by the deal that Woolworths has announced and says he is not sure that farms can supply enough eggs if caged hen production methods are phased out. I don't think many consumers realize what free range can mean. Caged hen production systems are often very clean and tightly monitored and are often very high tech with happy and healthy hens. They can control temperature, parasites to provide a clean delivery of food. These are vastly superior to what you would get in many of the free-range operations. With large-scale egg production, you can get chickens walking over other chickens, eating other chickens' feces, and I'm not sure if that is what you have in mind with free-range. Also, a lot of producers have just invested to change the cage sizes to fulfill new requirements, and they have done that in goodwill, thinking that it will fulfill all the requirements. You can't keep putting cost on top of costs. I have set up a meeting between Woolworths and the egg industry to try and talk through some of these concerns. I'll be posting this article a little bit later, of course, on our Facebook page. And what say you out there? What do you think when you hear cage-free chickens may not be as happy and healthy as chickens in a cage? So this will be probably a long debate, like which came first, chicken or the egg. But I saw that. I knew it would rub some people the wrong way. And so I will post that a little later on my Facebook page, because a lot of people are interested in the welfare of the animals. And we've had some big, big corporate folks on the show that had millions of chickens, and they actually stated, and they said, we'd be happy to show you our paperwork that would show that we lose more hens to cannibalism and illness and disease and other things in our free range. Now, you listen to the show long enough, you know free range means nothing, but you have 60,000 hens in one big house. They're just walking on the floor. There's just no cages. That's it. It's not pretty little pastures with little daisies popping up in a red barn in the background. We've done article on article and article on this. We've been on Fox News with this and trying to set the record straight. But they say they lose much more hens due to cannibalism and illness and other reasons when they have 60,000 hens in this one big warehouse versus if they had this one big warehouse with all the cages in it. So believe what you want, but I saw that and wanted to share it with you guys and Chickens in the News and post it. And like our good friend Peter Brown, the chicken doctor who's coming on shortly, says, sick and dead and injured birds don't pay the bills. So just kind of one of those things. See, I had another one here. If it would if it'll open up, I'll share with you with our Chickens in the News segment today. Here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, I appreciate you tuning in today. Yes, we do. Let me go ahead and pull this up here. And there's so many of these, it's hard to cover them every single day. It would be just flood our Facebook page. So we want to take due diligence with that, make sure people don't get just over bombarded with posts. Paul Puckett considers allowing residents to raise chickens and honeybees. Will Paul Puckett become the next Rhode Island community to allow residents to raise chickens and honeybees? Nancy Witt, a representative of the Paul Puckett Healthy Foods Coalition, has sent letters to Mayor Ronald R. Greben proposing an ordinance change that would make it possible. Now, this is in Rhode Island. Isn't the state bird the chicken, the Rhode Island Red, and they're allowed to keep them? That's odd. Witt says the letter that raising chickens would benefit people in Pawtucket by increasing access to eggs, a low-cost protein source. These eggs would be more nutritious, she said, due to the varied diet of residential chicken hens and would reduce the risk of disease contributed to the crowded conditions of commercial production facilities, which we just talked about in previous Chickens in the News. Barrington, Providence, and South Kingstown have already enacted regulations allowing residents to raise chickens, reflecting a national trend of small-scale or residential farming in urban settings. In Pawtucket, the proposals on chickens and bees arose from a Healthy Places by Design grant awarded to several Rhode Island communities. The Pawtucket Citizens Developed Corporation was commissioned to run a week-long forum soliciting ideas to make the city a healthier place to live, according to Andrew Pearson, an associate with the group. He says the Nantucket Healthy Food Coalition emerged, including representatives from such local organizations as New Urban Farmers and Farm Fresh Rhode Island. It also includes Witt, who represents Pawtucket Citizens Development Cooperation on the coalition. And let's see, in her March 29th letter, Witt says only one hen could be kept per 800 square feet of land with a maximum of 6 chickens per lot, mirroring the language in the Providence Ordinance. At this population level, chicken hens make very little noise or waste, the letter states, and she added the proposal specifically prohibits any roosters, which are generally responsible for the noise associated with poultry, from being kept on residential property. In her letter supporting honeybees raised at home, Witt wrote that residential gardens are more likely to bear produce if pollinators can easily access blooms. She wrote that the bees will be permitted only on lots of at least 7,000 square feet. This helps ensure that residential honeybee populations do not present a nuisance or run out of available food sources. So this is happening all across the country, folks. It has for years. We do report on it. We travel the country. We talk to courts. We talk to citizens, the whole nine yards, trying to educate them on all the great benefits of backyard poultry. And we've been very instrumental in changing some very important laws all across this great land. So we're going to continue to do that as well. And then I've got this one more that's interesting. I saw it kind of sparked my interest as well. I'm not sure what your religious affiliation is, and it doesn't really matter whether you pray or send out good vibes or good feelings or uplifting thoughts or whatever the case may be, but it's caught my eye here from the Berkshire Eagle News. Animals blessed at St. Helena's Episcopal Chapel in Lenox. And I'll scroll down and read just a little bit of this. I'll post this on the Facebook page as well. Frank and Lorraine Tabankin love golden retrievers. The Lennox couple's latest, Bailey, displayed the playfulness and affection three others of the canine breed have brought them and their family for nearly 30 years. I get up mornings and I have just one slipper and a bone in place of the other, noted Frank. It's pretty obvious who made the switch. Tapankin's granddaughter, Rebecca Robinson, feels blessed. She gets plenty of playtime with Bailey. He's cute and very spoiled, she said. He's like jumping on you and hugging you and playing with you the whole nine yards. On Sunday, Bailey was among 48 dogs, along with 6 chickens, one Persian cat, and a lizard, who gathered with their masters for the blessing of the animal service at St. Helena's Episcopal Chapel. The outdoor ceremony, similar to one held by several area churches this weekend, pays homage to St. Francis of Assisi, the patron saint of animals and the environment. I pronounce that, I apologize. The Italian flair for the late 12th and early 13th centuries believed humans and creatures of land, sea, and the skies equally share the earth, according to Virginia Vogel, a minister at St. Helena's. They share in the ways of human beings. They have a part of our lives, she said. Francis, the saint, recognized this when he called the animals wild and tame, his brothers and sisters. Mary Yee of Dalton brought her 6 chickens to be blessed because they provide eggs as well as make for unique family pets. Daughter Peggy Yee showed off one of her 2 black chickens called Silkies. They are one of 3 breeds with feathers on their legs and 5 toes, Peggy noted. While the chickens, dogs, and the lone cat seemed accepting of the divine blessing, Izzy was a bit unnerved by the attention. The ghetto-sized lizard couldn't handle the excitement, according to his young owner, Andrew Lemon, visited from Connecticut. He's changing color because he's stressed. Green, he's happy, said Andrew. So have you ever took your pets to an animal blessing at your place of worship? Very interesting. I will post this also on our Facebook page after the radio show. Also, don't forget, we will be having a giveaway today on our Facebook page. We'll be giving away a 1-year subscription to Back Home Magazine to 1 lucky Facebook fan. So just tune in periodically on our Facebook page and let us know and follow the directions, and you too could have a chance to win that. Okay, it's 20 past the hour. It's time to head over to the phone lines and bring on our really, really, really good friend, Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. Let's give him a big chicken whisperer welcome. Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Hey, Andy, how are you? Doing well.
I'm doing very well. It's a beautiful weekend up here. The leaves are changing, a beautiful golden color, golden and red and all this kind of great stuff here in the mountains. We're enjoying it. I think I'm going to take my dad and family on a midday picnic or something later in the week. We'll have to see based on the radio schedule and go do some leaf looking and get some pictures and whatnot. We'll post pictures of that, of course, on our Facebook page. But may have to do that. I think this weekend, next week, will be the prime season up here for the leaf changes, and as the temperature starts to drop and we get into fall, so we're having a great time and looking forward to it. Just loving it here, and we're going to hate to leave here where we're at. We've been here for I guess a little over 2 months now, and we'll be heading out. I think we got to go up to Nashville for a big event with Tractor Supply, and we'll be heading down to Florida maybe for the winter months, but I'll have to break away from there to do some tours this spring with Tractor Supply, I think. So, but I'm doing well, and I hope you are too. Thank you very much for joining us today. I had a request for this topic today from one of my Facebook fans, and they sent it over, I guess it was on Friday or Saturday whenever I emailed you, and they just wanted to learn more about this, and I said, well, I'll talk to Peter and see if we can have a show on it. We may have talked about it in the past, but since it was requested, we'd like to make our listeners happy. So,
I think it's been a long time since we covered this one. I do believe we did cover it at one time, but that's fine. It's always good to go back and visit them as we do and will do, continue to do. But it's an interesting subject, no question about it. Not something that's very common as a general rule. It just depends, I guess, more or less what the exposure is of birds to the disease organism, and we'll go into that in a minute as well. But it's an interesting disease from the standpoint that this is a very, 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 very old disease, as are most, but this one is like a founding father foundation disease. This disease and several others associated with cattle, I believe, were the basis for starting the U.S. Department of Agriculture's veterinary services side of their organization back in the 1800s. So this dates way, way back. It's a disease that was studied in Europe in the 1800s. If people can reach back and remember their science from school, Louis Pasteur, back in the about 1880 to 1881, in that range in there. This was the organism Pastorella multocida, is what it's called. The terminology foul cholera didn't come along until some years later. But at any rate, that's P-A-S-T-E-U-R-E-L-L-A, and then multocida, M-U-L-T-O-C-I-D-A. That's what we call the causative agent or the organism that causes it. It is a bacteria, and this is the one that Pasteur was able to basically purify all the way back then in the 1800s and grow it in chicken broth and then attenuate it and make it produce antibodies and prove that you could take these organisms, tone them down a little bit, and more or less point towards making a vaccine out of it. So that goes all the way back then. So it has a lot of history behind it. I guess that's my whole point there. But it wasn't until till later that it was actually, I take that back. It was earlier than the 1880 that it was first called foul cholera, and those came from Russian and French scientists back in about 1835, 1836, in that range. So it's a historical disease. Was one of the diseases that was prevalent enough back then and puzzling enough to help invoke the starting of the veterinary administrative side of the U.S. Department of Agriculture all the way back then. And so, there is a lot of history behind it. Today, it's not very common. It's not a disease that jumps to the forefront and on everybody's doorstep. But you still need to be on guard for it. Today, we see this predominantly, but not always, in small flocks, especially if they have the ability to free range. And you'll see it in free-ranging turkeys. It is a bigger problem, from my perspective, in turkeys. The commercial turkey side vaccinates quite frequently for this. There are multiple different vaccines available. We'll go into those types of things later. But it is a bacteria. Basically easily disinfected. Oxine will work. Bleach will work. Plain ordinary sunlight will and drying out of the bacterial organism itself will help kill it. So it's not one that, like some other diseases where there's actually a cell wall and like a capsule around it which protects them, this one doesn't have that. It does have a cell wall, but it doesn't have that encapsulation that we might see with some of the other disease organisms that might be around. So simple sanitation can keep this from being your worst nightmare. It can survive in contaminated soil, dead carcasses, and this kind of thing for anywhere up to 3 months and beyond. Just depends on temperature, direct sunlight, and so on and so forth. Speaking about dead carcasses, this is one of the reasons why you should never leave dead carcasses around to be consumed by the birds, because they certainly will do it, or any other predator for that matter. So when mortality occurs, those birds should be picked up and disposed of properly. One of my recommendations is one of two. Some people can't always do this, but either burn the carcass or take it and bury it real deep. That way predators, looking for a meal, are not about to dig it up and drag it around and cause havoc with it. I alluded to the fact that we see this more now in backyard flocks, mostly free-ranging, because that's where it's going to come from for the most part. Free-flying birds, waterfowl are known to have it. We've seen big die-offs of waterfowl every now and then. And when they go in and they pull out Pastorella maltosa, they're very sensitive to it. Turkey's very sensitive to it. So the carriers can be the free-flying birds, waterfowl especially, and that kind of thing. So that's why we would see it more so in a flock that's free-ranging and so on. And that's not a knock against free-range birds. I'm not saying you're going to see it in every backyard flock or anything like that. That's the what we call a vector or a mode of transmission of the disease from one group of birds to another. So birds that are running around, and by the same thing for them, if they come across a dead carcass of another bird, they're going to eat it. If it's contaminated with Pastorella multocida, they're going to spread it around. And your bird will spread it through its saliva in its mouth, its droppings, and so on, and carry it back to everybody else. So sanitation is important to, keep this thing out of your flock, paying attention to all the details, the little things. Our flock here doesn't really free range. They're penned in. It's a fairly large pen, but we still count everybody at night and know how many different birds we have, who goes where, who sits where on the roost, and if they're not there, we'll go look for them and find them wherever they're hanging out at and decided to hang out for the early part of the evening. So just knowing how many birds you basically have, and from time to time, do an inspection of your property. Any dead carcass of any animal laying around, you're better off to get rid of it, and that way it doesn't attract predators besides this particular disease itself. The improper disposal of dead carcasses. Some people just throw them out and pile out and back. All those kinds of things. Just not a good methodology to do this, and need to be dealt with in a different fashion. And one of my other favorite subjects too to talk about, and I'm just going to touch on it here, but rats and mice, big spreaders of this. So if you've got a rodent population that's growing, and at this time of the year it seems to be a habit, they're looking for a new home where it's warm and cozy, and if it's your barn or your home or whatever, they're going to invite themselves in. We will probably do a show here in a not too distant future and go back over rodenticides and baiting techniques and all of those kind of things. But if you've got a problem, now's the time to get it under control before it gets out of control. And how do the rats and the mice spread it? Well, they pick it up from eating other animals or carcasses or pieces of carcass that are infected, and then they shed it out in their droppings and in their urine. And so they get into your feed bucket, wherever you keep your feed, the feed that you leave out at night that's in a feeder. They get in there and they defecate in it and urinate in it, and the birds come in the morning. Birds don't know no better. They just jump right into the feed. They don't look too hard. And consume it, and then it's a possibility, a great possibility, that it'll be passed on that way as well. So, again, the greatest exposure is birds that are free-ranging, because you don't know what they're eating. I mean, they're out there, and, some of them got their favorite spots. We've talked about that before. A flock comes out in the morning, they all stand around, look, and then everybody heads off to different places, and maybe to some sort of a foraging thing that they were on yesterday that they remember that they liked, and so they go over there and they hang out, and I would always inspect those places just to make sure that they're not eating anything that they shouldn't be eating. And here we have a squirrel population that's pretty robust, and we've taken as much time and effort to keep them out front where the chickens are not, and doesn't mean they won't go on the back, but the enticement is to stay out front, and we do a little feeding of them and keep them busy so that they don't really go out and hang out in the chicken coop and that kind of stuff. So you limit your liabilities and things of that nature. And it's a disease that generally we see in older birds rather than young birds. Very rarely will you see it in a bird that is younger than 3 months old. I'm not saying it can't. I'm saying just don't see it as often in that age bracket. Probably has more to do with the ability of the disease organism to set up shop in the bird but we usually don't see it before that that type of an age bracket. Many times the only thing you may see is just sudden mortality that shows up for no reason whatsoever, none. You look the bird over and there's a picture of health top to bottom, but deader than a doornail. Okay, and so you just had a little discussion as well. I'll throw this in here because I think it's pertinent. We had a little discussion a day or so ago on Facebook, and somebody asked a question about, you know, are other people seeing, you know, with the turn of weather, seeing some mortality, and, you know, everybody chiming in, one here, two there, this, that, and the other thing. And my question was, you know, I really doubt that it is the weather per se. In other words, just because it turned cold doesn't mean chickens got to die. That's kind of silly. That's kind of like saying, you know, it was 90 here yesterday, it was 59 this morning, so when I went out this morning at 6 o'clock, I have the potential to die because the temperature dropped 30 degrees. That's kind of ridiculous. And so my point being that there generally always is an underlying issue that may have been brought to the forefront by the change in the weather, but it isn't directly the weather causing the bird to die. And so my question then was, you know, do you do post-mortem examinations, necropsies, on your birds when you find a dead bird? And the majority of the people, the answer is no. And I understand those that, you know, if your stomach is squeamish, you're not going to do it. If they're your best buddy and best pet and everything else, and your child's pet and what have you, you're not going to probably do it either. But it is a very wise decision to make that your business to find out. If you can't do it, take it to a lab. If you can't take it to a lab, find somebody that you know that will do it. Do you have to be skilled? Not necessarily. It's not a big deal. It isn't rocket science, any of it. In my opinion, the smartest thing to do is to get one of the disease posters off the website. And the only reason I tell you that is because it's a valuable tool to learn how to do this. It's a full-color poster, worthy of being framed. It's on a heavy, heavy, heavy glossy paper. All of the pictures on the periphery, the borders of the poster of all the major poultry diseases. So, I mean, and then in the middle of the poster is one bird completely posted with all the parts labeled so that you know what you're looking at. And that's how you start. And you can become quite adept at doing it all by yourself when you start comparing these things. And then, you know, if you are suspect about something, take a picture of it. Send it to me or whoever else you trust to make some sort of an assumption as to what's going on. And most people will be glad to help you. But just to throw them in a pile or burn them or bury them without knowing is counterproductive and can put the rest of that flock at serious risk. You know, so I think it's, you know, it's well worthy of folks to you know, to do that. And anybody from this show today that decides that they want to go there and pick up that poster, it's only $14.99, I believe. I'll split the postage with you. It has to go by priority mail. Can't go any other way because of the way we ship it. We don't fold it, bend it up in any way, shape, or form. And shipping a mailing tube through UPS or FedEx is too expensive. So it'll go priority mail, and so if you choose the poster, choose priority mail. When it's processed here in the office, we will take and split. So if it's a $10 shipping cost, you'll pay $5 plus the cost of the poster. So that's hopefully people will take advantage of that. If you never have to use it, it'll be the best $10-$15 bucks you ever spent. If you need to use it, it can be your best friend. So. You know, all of these things, to me, they're important. You need to know why they died and so on. And we do the same thing here when we have any mortality. Thank God we don't have a lot of mortality. You know, we had to put two down last week, but they were problem children from and been going on for a long, long time, and it just was time. That's all. But
let me point out another possible resource for folks. Last year, coming up on a year ago, last November, it was like one of the very last few days of November 2012. We had an amazing gentleman on from the university at UC Davis, and he had more letters after his name and the word fellow after his name than I've ever seen, regardless. But he came on, you may remember the show, and because I was hoping we could get it done, and it finally came about. But we did a complete two-hour show from beginning to end with this gentleman. And he does all the necropsies there in the state of California and at UC Davis, the whole night. I mean, we're talking expert with a capital E. Mm-hmm. And he, for 2 hours live on the show, walked us through step by step a necropsy. So you know that's a tool for folks. You've got the poster with Peter Brown, firststatevetsupply.com, firststatevetsupply.com. And then you can go back, and if you just type in Chicken Whisperer necropsy, it'll probably come up in Google. You'll click right to the show. But 2 hours from the time you walk into his office and hand him your dead chicken to the time he's handing you the report, he walks through verbally on this podcast every single step he does looking through and or performing a necropsy. And it was fascinating. It was one of my favorite shows of all time here. And so that can be a tool as well. If you're using the poster, you can actually visualize, because the podcast has no visual. So you've got the poster, and where you can identify different things, which is fabulous, and then you can walk through step by step doing it with the podcast, which of course is free on iTunes and podcast.com. And so that's I just wanted to, since you were mentioning that, that's another tool for folks that they feel
absolutely
like they can do themselves.
Yeah.
If
it's huge.
Want to do
I mean,
it themselves.
Yeah, it's huge for somebody to have these tools to work with. Because, for me it might be different, but for me I want to know. I want to know why. I want to know how come, and I want to know if we can fix it. And if so, how do we fix it? You know, and get all the information that you can together to, to make the flock healthier. And nobody likes losing birds. Nobody, I don't care who you are.
Exactly.
You know, if you're raising them, you don't want to lose them. So.
I don't want to mess you up or change your outline that you're following for the show, but let's move a little bit ahead. And we want the history of the disease. I don't want to interrupt you anything, but talking about the symptoms, what people are going to look for, how would they identify this, or if it's something that the vet would have to identify through testing, and then maybe prevention too, treatment. Do we call? Do we not call? And get into that as well. Again, don't want to rush your changes, mess up your outline.
No, I usually move along those lines, historically talking about it, what it is and that kind of stuff, how it spreads, and then you go into the symptomology. And the first symptom, like I said, that you might see is no symptom other than a dead bird. And sometimes, that's all you'll see. And this disease can be very tough to put your finger on, because there can be a multitude of symptoms that you might see, and some of them point to other diseases. So it can lead you off into the wild blue yonder when you should be, looking straight ahead at something else. So, but by and large, at the end of the day, I personally myself, for the most part, I've never really seen it where you couldn't really make a good assumptive diagnosis, on your own. Sometimes they do elude you. But you look for the telltale signs. For instance, if this were a disease, this particular disease rather settled down in the inner ear, you might see twisting of the head or the neck, similar to what you might see in Newcastle. So knowing that and looking at a bird with a twisted neck and so on, what's called torticollis, you would look at that and you'd go, is that Newcastle or not, you see? But by and large, probably not. As you start to examine the bird internally and look at some of the other things, we'll go into that in a minute, but I want to go over what you might see on the outside first. One of the other things, and don't forget, I always have to qualify some of these things, very rarely will you see every one of these symptoms pop up on a particular bird. It happens, but it is not the norm. The norm is that you might see 2-3 of these. In real severe cases, you might see an abundance of them, but very rarely will you see all of them all at one time. But it is possible. It does happen, but it's more rare, so I just want to point that out. So dark combs, or what we would call cyanosis, or a bird that's cyanotic, lack of oxygen, swollen face, swollen comb, swollen wattles, and they swell up pretty good. So it's obvious. It's not something you're going to look at and look at it and say that it's subtle. Okay, this is something you're going to look at and you're going to go, whoa, what happened? Are you getting a fight? You know, or something like that. And sometimes even that can. I've seen birds get nicked in the wattle and things start to swell up a little bit, and that can be a little bit. But this is pretty serious swelling in these things. Difficulty breathing, that panting, open mouth type breathing, you'll see large volumes of watery, usually with white urates in it, droppings, swollen joints, lameness, and all of these kinds of things are things that you may see in these birds on the outside before you even get to doing a necropsy. And generally this disease comes on very quickly, suddenly, as do a lot of diseases. But, you look at everybody today and everybody's, fat, dumb, and happy, and you come out in the morning and you've got a couple of dead birds. It's pretty hard to understand why it happened, how it happened, why is it, all of these things. And so that should be a tip-off for any disease, basically. But this particular one can be that way. And when you take a bird to a laboratory, let's say you just had some sudden mortality with no external symptoms, the face, the wattles, the comb were not swollen, the bird wasn't limping last time you saw it, there were no swollen joints that you could see and things of that nature, and you do a necropsy on them, you may not find a whole lot inside either. It has a tendency to settle down in the bone marrow, too. So a veterinarian doing a necropsy may decide to sample the bone marrow to see what else is going on. Some do, some don't. But that's generally what you would see with those kinds of things basically on the outside of the bird. As far as a necropsy is concerned, once you open the body cavity, one of the things that you may see is a liver that, instead of that nice bronze-looking color, it'll be a light tan and have some what we call necrotic foci or little white spots or off-colored spots on the liver. So you'd have a tannish colored liver compared to a bronze colored liver that we normally would see with spots on it. There may be some lesions growing on the lungs, a large amount of what we call exudate, a fancy word for pus basically, and you would see that maybe in the ears, the joints, if there are joint problems, swelling in the joints, lameness. You would see that in the tendon sheath. Tendons run through a little sheath, just like they do in humans, and you might see some accumulation of this pus material in those particular joints. The infraorbital sinus cavity, that would be around the eye. We talk about that all the time when birds have eye infections and they get those little lumps and stuff in there, and the eye gets puffed up on the outside and you can't see the eyeball because it's so swollen. Same kind of thing there. You may see some weeping of this pussy material from the infraorbital sinus cavities out through the eye in that area. You would see some in the body cavities. The body cavity, might even see it in the airways and that kind of thing. So when you get nodules on the lung and you get this mucousy stuff in the airway, you start to get that labored breathing and stuff. Again, those kinds of things can throw you off, say, well, it's got a respiratory issue. Well, yeah, but it's not the underlying issue, you see. And that's what I was trying to get to the other night on Facebook when we were talking about that. And that's, what is the underlying factor that's causing that mortality? It wasn't the weather. The weather may have triggered a chain of events that were coming down the road. It may have made it faster, but it wasn't the weather per se or the weather by itself that killed the chickens. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, it does if the bird was left out in the cold. It does if the bird got soaking wet. We talked about temperatures, and I brought this up. This is worth throwing back out, too, because it's starting to get temperature changes. Birds have much less tolerance to heat. The window of opportunity to save a bird who is under heat stress is much, much, much narrower than a bird that is cold stressed, hypothermic. So if we look at a bird, it depends on the bird, it depends on whether it's male, it depends on whether it's female, it depends on whether it's a bantam, it depends on whether it's a large fowl. But anywhere you're looking 104, 105 to 107 core body temperature, okay, or body temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Mortality starts at 113, 114 degrees. So you've got a very small window of opportunity there. You've got about 7 degrees body temperature rise, and you start to see mortality. The converse of that is looking at hypothermic, that could drop down to a core body temperature around 72, 75 degrees. You've got a big swing there. You've got a big swing. So you're trying to tell me, and I'm not talking about air temperature. I'm talking about core body temperature. So if indeed the weather is causing these birds to die, the weather directly, then they're not being kept properly. They're either exposed to wind. We talked about wind chill factor and how that can have an effect in lowering the core body temperature. We talked about that when we did that the whole deal on that.
Right.
There's a big difference between a bird being in a compartment and just being cold versus one where there's a bunch of drafts. So all of these things, the bird gets wet and all that kind of stuff, you're going to bring the core body temperature down a lot quicker. But you're not going to do it by having a 90-degree day today and a 59-degree night tonight. You're not. You're not going to bring that body core down under 75 degrees, not even close, because they're going to huddle up. They're going to get together. The birds are going to tighten up, fluff up, and get that body heat, keep it from escaping as much as they can. So I don't necessarily buy into the fact that the weather itself, all by itself, killed it, unless there are certain mitigating circumstances that aren't being explained, and it didn't appear to be any of those. It was a generalized question, as, yeah, hey, you know, the weather's changing. I hear people losing birds. Is this happening to you? And we just got in a general discussion. Not trying to force any, my opinion and my ideas on anybody. These are the cold, hard facts. They're not really an opinion. It is a fact. That is what the difference is. So you've got 75 up to 100, that's 25-degree spread right there. And if you want to take another 7 degrees, as far, let's say the bird, particular birds had 107 degrees, you've got 32 degrees of spread versus 7. So I don't see it. I don't see it happening. Weather all by itself, unless there were other mitigating circumstances, wet birds, this kind of thing. And I did see some people who had some rainstorms and lost some birds to the weather. That can happen. And under certain conditions, if it's cold enough and the rain's cold enough and the birds have been exposed long enough, it can happen very rapidly. But I don't see it in a dry condition where the temperature is just dropping and the birds are being kept properly and that kind of thing. You know, for instance, here last night, when I put the birds to bed here last night, we've got a big commercial ceiling fan that we put in there, and we put that on low, and it circulates all night. When I put them to bed in there last night, everybody sat dumb and happy, and it was right at 80 degrees in there. And everything's closed up. There's not a window open. There's nothing open when I put them in there. Doors closed, locked, done. Nothing in, nothing out. And when you go in there in the morning, they're crowing and carrying on like a bunch of fools. And, you know, just everybody just happy, jumping all down off the roost as soon as you come in, and so on, heading right straight to the feeders and waters and the whole bit. And even a couple of nights ago, we had temperatures down in the 40s. Still left the fan on in there. Never had any problem with it whatsoever. So I don't get it. And I'll get off that one right at the moment. And but just, you know, be aware of all of these things. So getting back to this exudative material, it can run anywhere from watery to a thicker pus to a cheesy-like material, too. Then you have to watch out there for E. coli infections, bronchitis, this kind of thing. And you'll start to separate these things out by how fast it spreads. This one's not a real fast spreader, but it can take over in a short period of time. It's not like some of the viruses like LT, bronchitis, and those that spread extremely rapidly. And that kind of thing. So you have to rule out mycoplasma, and you have to rule out, LT. You've got to rule out Newcastle. You've got to rule out all these other little things that go along with it to try to make this thing. But, you won't see, as a general rule, swollen wattle, swollen comb, and that kind of thing with Newcastle. You won't see it generally with bronchitis, LT, that kind of stuff. So you can start to make some assumptions and those kind of things. So that's what you would see on a necropsy. That which is what a veterinarian would see for the most part as he's doing some of these things to the bird. May also see some what we call petechial changes. These are little tiny specks of blood in some of the mucous membranes. You might see them down around the lungs and that kind of thing. More of another tip-off as to what's going on as far as that's concerned. Medication-wise, you know, most of the sulfa drugs are the drugs of choice. Most people would tell you that if you have this in your flock, you know, to put them down and depopulate, and that certainly is a choice. I think that I would opt to put down any bird that I found that had it immediately and dispose of the carcass as quickly and as efficiently as I could. I would disinfect. I would medicate immediately. And, you know, you can use a lot of things. It depends on whether or not the particular strain of the Pasteurella maltosa that's running around on your premise is one that's sensitive to one of the drugs. The more sensitive it is to one of the drugs, the better off it's going to work. So medications, sulfamethazine would work, or what people call Sulmet. Sulfadimethoxine would work. High levels of oxytetracycline would work, and water-soluble penicillin. Most people are not going to run around and give these birds injections unless you've got one or two birds or something like that. But any of those things would work. Baytril for a long time was a drug of choice, which has been taken off the market for use in chickens. And should not be considered for use. So I just throw that out there for people that really people want to run right to that particular medication, and it is not a drug of choice. Okay. As far as vaccination is concerned, the it's a mixed bag. The live cholera vaccines for poultry and turkeys have been a mixed bag from the standpoint that sometimes they cause as much trouble as they fix. And therefore, I am more of a fan, if you are interested in protecting your flock as best you can, and I would suggest the inactivated or killed fowl cholera vaccine. We don't carry it anymore. We used to carry it years ago, and there just wasn't that much call for it. But if somebody's got themselves in a position where they either feel they have exposure or they want to vaccinate for it, we could certainly get it. It's not a problem. Probably a little bit on the expensive side because of having to buy just one bottle versus having a large order of a whole bunch of bottles. But irregardless, it is available. The live vaccines, those you have to buy basically in bottle and packages of 10, and I would not be interested in doing that unless somebody was interested in 10 bottles, and I have no idea what the price structure is on that these days. Availability should be good on either one of these. The Bacterin, probably going to be about 75-80% protective for the most part. It's never been a real highly protective type of a vaccine. Again, you know, it is tough when you have birds that are running around free-ranging all over the place and having possible exposure. I know there's been some questions by some folks, you know, how do you keep the free-flying birds out of your flock? Well, if you ever find a way, let me know. But for the most part, you know, you really, by law, can't really do anything to them. You really can't kill them, and I don't think that's a good idea. I wouldn't be a fan of doing that. So it does become a problem from that standpoint. I would probably be more concerned if I was in an area where waterfowl were going to sit down and hang out for a week. because they're the probably number one spreader of this particular type of thing as far as the free flying birds are concerned. So those are your choices as far as the vaccination route is concerned. The Bacterans have less problems, but yet, in my opinion, probably some less protection. The lives have more protection, but more problems. And again, it goes to that mixed bag thing. And from my perspective, if I had to do it and I had the exposure, I would opt to use the Bacterin and start there. Now, as far as culling is concerned, I'm not a big fan with this particular disease of trying to nurse a bunch of carrier birds back to health so they can keep spreading it. So my thing would be to medicate birds that are showing symptoms, eliminate, and again, dispose of those carcasses properly, and disinfect as often as you can. I'll say this, and I know it's expensive, and I know from experience of doing this for many, many years, that for many small flock holders, it always, not always, but the majority of the time, it comes down to dollars and cents. And I get that. I understand that. Very well aware of it, even with what we do here. I've spent plenty of money on some things that I've scratched my head about some days. But but at any rate, I would getting a fogger, and you want, if you're going to fog with oxine, which is EPA labeled to do with birds in place, meaning the bird in the coop, okay, if you're going to do that, you want to get a fine particle sprayer that is going to atomize the oxine in such a fashion that it is going to be available to the birds to actually swallow and get down into their airways and that kind of thing. And it's going to cut down in the coop the amount of the disease organism that's available. This goes for not just this disease, any disease, whether it be Merrick's, whether it be laryngotracheitis, whether it be an E. coli outbreak or any other disease problem that may be going on. You know, once you get over the initial expense of buying the fogger and you take care of it, you've got it for basically ever. It's a long-term type of thing. The oxine's not overly expensive. 6.5 ounces of oxine to a gallon of water. You put it in your sprayer. You put your sprayer at about 30 inches off the floor in your coop, and you run. You tighten up the coop as best you can. Close all the windows and doors, and then you run an extension cord so that you're outside the building. You plug in your extension cord. You watch through the crack of the door as the fogger goes on and fogs the building till you can just about see the birds. Pull the plug, close the door, wait 15 minutes, air the joint out. And if I had a disease outbreak going on that required something like that, I would try to do that twice a day and then once a day after that until it's done, and maybe once a week or so, or once every 2 weeks after that. Because, you know, the dust and the dirt and the dander that the birds give off, as we all know, gets all over the place. I mean, we started out with a brand new coop, brand new painted inside, and the birds have only been here now a couple of months, and, you know, already it needs a good cleaning in there. We're going to do that here shortly. So, you know, we're going to fog it, set the fogger and all that kind of stuff, you know, throw everybody out and you know, wash it all down, clean it up. You know, it's not dirty, 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 but it's, you know, you can, you know, on the upper rafters and stuff that are exposed, only a couple, but you can still see it. So if there is any disease organisms around, that's where it's going to be, and all that little damned dust, dirt, and junk hangs around, you know. So it's a good idea. If you can swing it dollar and cents-wise, you can go on the Internet and you can buy them. Trying to remember the name of the one was made by Dynafog anyway, and I can't remember the name of it. Doesn't matter. But it's a good inexpensive fogger to have. When I say inexpensive, you know, it's all relevant. But You buy it as cheap as you can. Great tool for containing this disease or any other disease that may come along. We talked a little bit about the prevention of this. And again, you know, free-flying birds, not much you can do there. Rodent control, I would get on a rodent control program using some bait stations. And we will go over this when we do another show on rodent control. But if you're having an ongoing problem now or you want to get a head start on it and you want to send me an email to chickendr@firstaidvetsupply.com, I've got the plans and stuff for two feeders. One you can make out of PVC, the other you can make out of a simple piece of one by. So we've got some detailed drawings of those. They're free if you all you got to do, and we don't email you back with a bunch of ads and crap. We're not interested in that. You know, just email me and we'll take care of it from that standpoint. But you know, this disease can be devastating because it, you know, you're not going to clean it up out of your flock once it gets in there if you don't get rid of the carrier birds and start treating and vaccinating immediately. And it's going to be a tough deal. It's not going to be easy at all. But long history with this particular one. Again, you know, just to go back over these symptoms, I think it's important. Again, mortality may be your only symptom. There may be some swelling of the comb, the wattles, either one or both, the infraorbital space around the eye, so they may look like they got smacked in the head. When you see one that's got the whole, you know, the head thing, you can see quite often. You'll see the both wattles swollen, the comb, and at least one side of the face swollen and stuff like that. That's fairly common. When you see this, and that's kind of interesting because it does look like they were in a prize fight and didn't get anything for it. So it's an interesting thing to look at, but that's what you're going to see as far as that's going to be concerned. You may look in the mouth and you may see some of those what we call petechial hemorrhages, just little spots in there that shouldn't be huge, but that's one of the things that you'll see. You can see some, you know, swollen joints. They can be wing joints, leg joints. Doesn't really matter. Birds who have this in the inner ear and that kind of stuff, you might see some twisting of the neck and that kind of stuff. So I think that's all I've got.
I've got a few scenarios or a few questions, but I do want to go to a commercial break before, and then when we come back, I will pick your brain on a few things. You know, we just found it. Do I need to, you know, some of the things like isolate my bird, or that first bird we see symptoms, I need to call that bird and then start treating like crazy with the others, and will they always be carriers, and how can I treat the dirt and the run, you know, the oxygen and things like that. So just a few questions regarding that. Folks, if you're just tuning in, you can listen to this show in its entirety because every show is archived for your listening pleasure. Normally happens about 30 minutes after the show goes to an end. So if you missed anything, don't fret. You can listen to all of our shows. I think this is episode 866, and they are all archived for your listening pleasure, so don't fret. But we are talking with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply, and we will return right after this short break with more.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com. Do you provide a heat source for your backyard chickens in the winter? In most cases, it's not necessary. But if you choose to provide a heat source for your backyard chickens, it's imperative to use a safe and effective heat source, and the only one I recommend is the Sweeter Heater. The Sweeter Heater is a safe, completely sealed, washable,
non-breakable, energy-efficient, long-lasting, and reliable specific area heater that comes with a 3-year warranty. Ditch the dangerous heat lamp this season and invest in the only heater I recommend, the Sweeter Heater. Purchase the Sweeter Heater online at sweeterheater.com. That's sweeterheater.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer. If you're in the market for a new incubator, then look no further than GQF. They have a great selection of tabletop and cabinet-style incubators at prices you can afford. I love my GQF Genesis Model 1588. It has a large picture window and an automatic thermostat, which makes for a better hatch every time. Go pick out your new incubator at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
How would you like a punch in the beak?
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce, I'll don my super suit.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, and of course our guest today, as always on Monday, Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. Visit him at firststatevetsupply.com. If they don't have it, you don't need it. So again, yes, thank you very much for tuning in, and the show will be archived for your listening pleasure shortly after we end the show. So just a few questions, and we'll wrap up, Peter. And again, thank you very much for coming on. Great topic.
Sure.
And very knowledgeable. The so we find that first chicken that we suspect has this issue. You talked about finding that first one with symptoms, that it may be the carrier that spreads, like you said, very quickly. It could be very devastating. It could be very just a bear to try to manage and get under control for probably maybe years to come, you said. So, you know, you recommend maybe culling that first bird and then start an advanced and quick treatment of the others. How about isolation? Is it something that, you know, if we just don't feel like calling, if it's just not something we do, this is Henrietta and Precious and Petunia, we separate that first chicken to try to start a treatment program, or does it matter if this disease, like you're saying, can spread very, very quickly and can be really disastrous, or is that an issue, or do we just start, you know, keep him or her with the rest and then totally treat all of them as we would that isolated bird?
Well, yeah, culling is as we've talked about many times, and even my own philosophy, it's a very difficult thing for a lot of people to make. I mean, even myself, I've been around birds many, many times. I've culled zillions of birds over the years commercially and what have you, but it's never fun to put them down, never. And when it becomes fun to put them down, there's something wrong with you. But other than that, I mean, yeah, isolation is the first thing you should do. And, you know, it's a matter of making sure that if you're going to isolate the bird, you need to isolate the bird away from everybody else and then make sure that that bird is the last bird you handle for the day. And, you know, as long as you're not walking in this bird's, you know, manure and it's not snotting from the nose or the mouth or something like that and getting on you and that kind of thing, you know, I think, you know, you still have to watch your biosecurity, no question about it, but I don't think you have to jump off the deep end, but you have to be reasonable. Right. Everything has to be, you know, certain things you can do, certain things you can't do. You know, sure. We're in a position here where our ability to isolate birds who become ill is very, very limited. So we have to be careful what we do here, too. I mean, it's that way for everybody. You know, as far as the coop itself is concerned, they've got plenty of room inside, more than they probably need, and they've got more than they need outside. And but, you know, it just wasn't in the cards to make it bigger to make, and I wouldn't make it in the coop itself anyway, so it would mean another outbuilding somewhere else, and it's just right now not in the cards. And I'm not even sure that I would do that. But you know, the last two, we have a pantry room in here that's not used as a pantry, and we were able to bring the two of them in there and try to doctor them the best we could for their two abnormalities. One of them, I'm sure in my mind, can't be, you know, when I say sure, I'm sure that it had a blood abnormality. The rescue bird that we had gotten quite some time ago, and it had some funky feet, and one of them was real bad, and I'd like to have it operated on and have the tissue removed and everything else, you know, by a qualified veterinarian and what have you, and you know, put on all the antibiotics and stuff that we were told to do with that particular bird with that particular problem, change in dressings, and just never healed, never. Anything and everything that we did to it. I mean, if I told you how much money was spent just trying to fix this foot, you'd probably maybe you're sick. But it's at the end of the day, it's a learning process, you know, trying to learn how to fix this and how to make it better. And eventually, you know, with the, you know, even the guidance of another veterinarian who didn't do the original operation because they were in another state and, you know, decided that it was time, just time. You know, because every time, and I don't care what dressing we used natural things from honey, and you know, I'm telling you, we went the gauntlet on this thing. You know, I should own part of the dressing company. But, you know, it's the thing you got to do. It's the responsibility you take on. We did everything under the sun and ran out of options. Just wouldn't heal. Every time you took the dressing off, it was stuck to everything, even, and when we put things on, like aloe and honey and all those kind of things, it just made everything squishy. It just didn't get any better. I think it was some sort of like a leucosis offshoot of something that's in the blood that just would not scab up the way it's supposed to do. And any time it did form a scab, it was still all squishy under the bottom. It just never got anywhere with it. Never. You know,
I know what the problem was. You used honey. When you're dealing with a chicken, you should have used either teriyaki or sweet and sour.
Well, I got a friend of mine. He said the best thing you could do is celery and carrots and potatoes. So, but aside, you know, we did everything we could. And,
yeah.
You know, so absolutely. Sometimes you have to do that. And so, yeah, isolation, evaluate, you know, and that kind of thing. Yeah. Look for other birds in the flock that start to come down with those kinds of things. Disinfect, you know, immediately. Do as much as you can, you know, as much as you can. I realize people work, people have children to take care of, you know, household to take care of, all of those things, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm here. I'm here by myself this week. Tammy went home to visit her daughters, and I'm here. I'm the head flock master this week. So, you know, so I have to, you know, and you know my situation here with as many roosters as we've got. I can't let them out before 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So it's down to cardio rehab a little earlier and get back here and get this done and everything else and, you know, and try to get all that done before I get on the air here. So, you know, it's a mad dash, but, you know, I'll survive it. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah. And would you say, okay, let's take that first bird, it succumbs to the disease, it's a goner. We've got this another flock of, who knows, let's say 12 to 20 birds. We're going to treat that. We're going to disinfect. How, and we'll treat very heavily, and some of the information I've read and you were talking about, this may stay with your flock maybe forever, but disinfecting the runs, doing the mist and your coops, treating your birds, the whole nine yards, mm-hmm. I guess even with all that, you still, 6 months from now, maybe have an outbreak or see that, oh, here's this next bird with this symptom, and then here we go again, or is it,
I think it can
be treated pretty efficiently and effectively long term?
I think the answer to the question is that, mm-hmm. let's go back to your scenario, this one bird, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you decide to euthanize that bird. Let's just use that scenario.
Okay.
You look at it, and you see the swollen wattles, you see the swollen comb, you say, oh, my God, got a problem.
Yeah.
You yank it out of there, you euthanize the bird. If you have the opportunity to take it to a laboratory, I certainly would. That'd be my first option. Okay? If you don't, I would look at this bird myself.
Right.
Okay? And try to make some judgments there, call around, call me, or whatever. We'll try to put our heads together and do the best we can from where we're all sitting. That being said, the next line of defense is to, in my opinion, go out and, you know, clean up, disinfect, and everything. And here again lies the problem, you know, running a household, a job, all these other things that you know, kids off to soccer or whatever the heck is going on. I mean, we all have lives, so, you know, these things, you know, can get... So the longer it's left unchecked, that is the greater opportunity for other birds to become infected from the bird that you pulled out.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the quicker you can get to it, the better off you are, and you might be able to stop it in its tracks. It just depends, you know, and here we go again, you know, birds defecate in the water, and that's one of the major ways it's spread, and, you know, so how many birds have been exposed already? I certainly, you know, this is kind of like a shotgun type approach, too, at the same time, but I would probably clean up and then turn right around and, you know, put medication into water and hope that they can ward this off. But by all means, wherever possible, get a necropsy done, and, you know, It's well worth the opportunity to do that. And I realize, you know, some of these states now have gone wacko charging, you know, $200 to do a necropsy on a bird, you know. And you know the funny part about it, and the part that really gets me, they want everybody to be in the community. They want everybody to be in the fold. Well, why do you invite me in with a $200 bill? You know, why don't you you know what I mean? Why don't you use some common sense and say, yeah, we'll be glad to take a look at that bird and see what we can find out and help guide you. But none of them do that. The guidance that you get from them is, you know, put your whole flock down. Well, it makes a whole lot of sense. You know, and easy for them to say when there's no connection to it monetarily or emotionally, you know. So,
right.
Or even income-wise. You know, some people make money off their flock, whether it be eggs or whatever. And here's the kicker. If this is an egg flock, you're probably not going to see much egg production out of them once they, you know, really start turning sick on you. And then with whatever you're going to medicate them with, I don't know when you would be able to sell those eggs to anybody. It would be a long time. So, you know, all those factors have to be factored in, you know, when you're trying to do some of these things. But, you know, you were asking then, okay, so we've culled the bird. We're getting a necropsy done. We dump some medication into the water. We clean up the coop. You know, we take out all the shavings. We fog. We do this. We do that. And now we come to the run. And that therein lies technically the hardest part of it because your birds have to use it all the time. Your best bet there is to get a bag of hydrated lime and lime it and work it into the soil. And that's going to be the best thing you can do there. Change that pH so they can't live and ward it off. If you have to get, you know, an alternative run for your birds to be in, if that's a possibility, I would certainly do that and clean this other one up and so on until you get a handle on it. It's not easy. not easy. Handling diseases within a flock are never easy because of how easily some of these things are spread bird to bird. And, it is an issue. There isn't any question about it. But that's the way I would go about doing it.
Okay.
And as much or as little as you can do. Some people believe, I got in a conversation the other day with somebody about, they believe in letting the immune system take over. Okay, I'm okay with it. They're your birds. But when you get a bunch of dead, sick birds, that aren't worth anything at the end of the day, you can't do anything with them. And, just because they're recovered doesn't mean they're healthy,
right.
End up being carriers, and that kind of stuff. So it's a mixed bag. It's not as easy as people would think. So.
And then the segue into wrapping up the show with what you said at the beginning of the show, they're carriers. And any bit or amount of stress could then aggravate that carrier bird, and here they've come back and they're showing symptoms, and you've got this issue. Like we've talked so many times on the show about the quarantine period and bringing new birds and just the stress and things like that. My birds are healthy. Really? How do you know?
Yep.
Until they're stressed or until you get them tested, then, well, they're healthy. How do you know? So that's great information. As always, Peter Brown, we're so glad that you come on and educate us on this topic as well. Yeah, I figured it had been a while. I think we had done it, but it had been a while. So good topic, good day, and a great person to share their knowledge with today with you. So if you have any questions for Peter, chickendr@firststatevetsupply.com. That's chickendr@firststatevetsupply.com. And, of course, there you can go get take a look at that poster he's got with all the disease poster, which is fabulous. And, again, don't forget, and with his poster, so you have a visual of different disease, you've got the two-hour oral presentation of a necropsy from the very first time he picks the bird up to the time he gives you the report of what's wrong with it, step by step by step by step. And using those, if you feel like you can do that, do it on your own, especially like Peter said, your state's charging, your poultry lab $200 or more for a necropsy on this $3 bird, then that may be something you feel like you can do yourself. And like Peter said, very beneficial. Hey, Peter, thanks very much for coming on today, as always. And every single Monday you join us, for our new listeners, you can tune in Monday and hear him and a topic that will keep our chickens healthy. So thanks for tuning in. We'll see you. Thanks for coming on, Peter, and we'll see you next week.
We'll be there. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And that's Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, firststatevetsupply.com. And that, my friends, is going to wrap up another episode of Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We hope you can tune in every day, Monday through Thursday, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Blog Talk Radio. We do thank you for tuning in. And let's see, tomorrow we've got the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy coming on. Wednesday, Alexander Douglas, the Quail Lady. Thursday, publisher of Back Home Magazine, Richard Frudenberger. We've got a full lineup this week. Hope you can tune in each and every day. God bless everybody. Oh,